Amazon Web Services.
Welcome to the Cloud and Out podcast. My name is Andreas.
And my name is Michael.
We are brothers and freelancers focusing on Amazon Web Services. We do technical coaching, for example, for teams that start their journey with AWS. And infrastructure bootstrapping, typically based on our infrastructure as code templates for our clients worldwide. Every other week, we discuss a topic related to AWS in this podcast. One of us prepares the topic which is not known to the other one. And that's why I'm asking Michael, what's the subject for today?
Yeah, Andreas. So today we talk about a way to improve IAM policies by looking at data. And you might think, okay, that's CloudTrail, that's obvious. But no, it's not CloudTrail. We are going to use another method that is, in my opinion, more accurate, and it's called client-side monitoring.
Michael, that sounds very interesting because coming up with IAM policies or improving IAM policies in a way that they follow the least privilege principle is always something I'm struggling with, and probably everyone is who is doing stuff on AWS. That's why I'm very interested in that topic. Before we start, I have to mention this is episode 27. We are recording this on September the 10th, 2020. And as always, you will find a blog post that covers the topic as well. You will find a link to that in the show notes. So especially if you want to go through it later, that's a very easy way to do so. So check that out.
Okay, Andreas. So you already mentioned it, that this is kind of a common problem. So I experienced this at least three times this year already. So when I was working for clients, so I get a setup, I see IAM policies that are already created, and my task basically is to look at them and understand if they are actually following the least privilege principle. Okay. So what does it mean? Basically, the idea is that you only allow the actions on the resources that you should. And all the other stuff is not allowed. And this is pretty hard from an outsider if you're looking at a system. And the only way to figure out if that is actually correctly configured is to look in the past and see what calls were actually made, and then use this as a discussion with the team that runs the software to figure out if we can improve that. And the problem always was that CloudTrail lacks so many information. So all of the, I would say, interesting API calls from a machine's perspective. So for example, if you get messages from SQS, this will not show up in CloudTrail. If you download something from S3, it only shows up in CloudTrail if you enable data events, for example.
Yeah, absolutely. So CloudTrail is missing a lot of the API calls, but maybe just to introduce that. So CloudTrail is a service that is intended to have an audit log of all the things that are going on in your AWS account. That's basically the marketing slogan, I would say, that AWS uses here. And it's definitely, there's a lot of missing there. That's a very good thing here. And I would make it to get the problem from my perspective as well. So I think there's two different things here. So sometimes you get an application that was maybe built by an independent software vendor, and you just have to operate that on AWS. And if they do not provide an IAM policy in their documentation, you basically have no other chance than using CloudTrail or what you will show us today to find out what's going on. Or the worst thing is basically this trial and error to figure out or to guess the API calls that the application is doing. If you have access to the source code, you could, in general, you could find out about the SDK calls that they are using and try to guess from there. But oftentimes you don't have access to that, and then it's really hard to get that up and running. And that's probably also why I see many cases customers are completely not doing the least privilege principle when creating their IAM policies, because it's so hard to get that done, and then there's not enough time to do so and stuff. Yeah. So very interested. How does it, maybe you can tell us a little bit, how does that work? How do we use that?
Yeah. So let me add one thing. So as you mentioned, like if if you find something that was not following least privilege principle, for example, if you see like DynamoDB full access or something like this attached to an EC2 instance, you know that's bad. But the question now is, okay, what is actually needed? And it's so super hard to make this decision without interrupting the application. And that's why we have to look at data, and I will show you how it works. So the feature that we use is called client-side monitoring. And it's, as I said, a feature of the CLI and all the SDKs. So if you are using a one of those ways to call APIs of AWS, then you are covered. So it's not working if you call the APIs directly.
Yeah, but probably that's not a problem, because I think probably 99% of all applications are using the SDKs because it's making it so much easier to interact with the AWS API. So
yeah, I agree. So I mean, if you find something really old, it's like maybe like from the early days of AWS, then this might be a problem. But like if there's a recent up-to-date application that's integrated into AWS, then you are fine. Okay, so how can we enable it? So there are basically two ways to enable it. And this works across the SDKs and across the CLI. It's the same for whatever you use to connect to AWS. There's an environment variable called AWS underscore CSM underscore enabled. And if you set that to true, then this SDK will start to provide this information on UDP port 31,000. The other way of configuring is that I usually use as well. There's this thing called the shared configuration file in AWS, and it lives in the home directory under the .aws directory, and it's called, the file is called config. And there you can set a CSM underscore enabled variable to true or setting to true. And then also the SDK and the CLI are instructed to turn client-side monitoring on. So those are the two ways. So what I usually do is, like, if I want to monitor or capture the data from such a machine, I will go through all the users on the machine and add this into their configuration file in the AWS directory. And then I also look through the processes that are running and see how they are started. If they come with the home environment variable, then the SDK will be able to fetch the shared configuration file. The problem is if the home environment variable is not available, which is like if you have an interactive shell session, the home environment variable is always there. Like for humans, it's not a problem. But it gets problematic if, like, for example, for daemons that are running, like if there's no home environment variable, then the shared configuration file will not be fetched by the SDK. So in this case, you could either set the home environment variable or you set the AWS CSM enabled environment variable directly. So the big question is how to debug this. And there are basically two ways that I usually go. One is you can get the UDP stream onto your machine using TCP dump. And the command is in the blog post, so I'm not going to spell it out here. So there are a couple of options. But basically, it's a way to listen to the UDP port on in your shell. And the other command that I really like, or the other debug tool that I like, is you can actually get access to all the environment variables of all the processes if you're a root user by looking into slash proc slash then the process identifier slash the file is called environ. And there you can see all the environment variables that are defined. The problem with this file is that instead of like listing environment variables with a slash n like carriage return character, they separate environment variables with a 0 byte, which is not really shown nicely if you open it with cut, for example. So that's why I have some magic command in the blog post as well that displays you this strangely formatted file in a nice manner so that you see the environment variables underneath each other instead of in one long line. But you can also use cut to do the same thing. It's just a little bit harder to read.
Okay, Michael, so let me ask a question if I understand that correctly. So basically, what I need to do to get the client-side monitoring feature of the SDK or the CLI up and running is I either configure it in the AWS config file, or if that is not possible, I can also use an environment variable. And basically what you talked through now is how I can check if a running process, so the process of the application, is using an AWS config file or an environment variable. So I can check and debug that basically with what you have described here.
Yeah, and there's this one like detail, like if you, for example, configure for the root user, there's a .aws directory, and within that it's a config file, and you might now think, okay, everything is fine. The problem is if you start a process as root, mm-hmm. and this process has not defined the home environment variable, it will not fetch the configuration file, because this only works if the home environment variable is defined. So that's how the SDKs are programmed, to figure out where to look at for the file. Yeah. So those are the like the details. There's one another hint that I want to give here, like, because lots of those daemons are started with systemd in Amazon Linux 2 at least. It's very easy to inject environment variables with systemd. So each like what you have, like a init file, like it's kind of the unit file in systemd. And there you can just add a single line where you say environment equals and then environment variable equals a value. And then you can populate an environment variable to the process. So this is also in the blog post, like the details. And this is very handy for things like the SSM agent, CloudWatch logs agent. Like there are a couple of agents running by default on Amazon Linux 2, like EC2 instance connect. I mean, there's really a lot of stuff running out of the box without maybe everyone noticing it. So for all those like daemons that run in the background, it makes sense to configure that. And then you get all the data.
Okay, Michael. So then that's another thing I want to repeat if I understood it correctly. So if I enable the client-side monitoring for my process, for my CLI, whatever, I then have basically to listen on port 31000 to get the information from client-side monitoring. So all of the tools, the SDKs, the CLIs, all send it to the same UDP port. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's correct. And they send it to the loopback interface. So it's local. It's not published to the outside world. Mm-hmm. But yeah, that's correct. If you really like, you can also change the port. So there's also an environment variable for that. And you can also do it in the config file. But I just go with the defaults here to keep things simple. But yeah, that's correct. They will all send their data to the same port. So the next important question is, now that we have all this data coming in on the port, on the UDP port, we need to capture it. And we need to send it somewhere for our to make our lives easier to analyze the data. And what I think it's the easiest way here, and the way that has with least effort, is we use Fluentd, and Fluentd can listen on UDP port, it can do some transformation, and it can upload to S3. And that's kind of all we need. So that's why I go with Fluentd, and it's also pretty easy to install on Amazon Linux too.
Okay, maybe one question. The data that is coming from the client side monitoring, is it already in a machine readable format? Is it JSON or something? Or
exactly, it's JSON, and Fluentd can also pass that JSON for us. So it's Fluentd really is a good fit here, I think. There are a couple of other ways of doing it, and I mean, you can do whatever you like. I think that's an easy one. So it works and it's proven, and it's a lot of documentation out there and a big community. So Fluentd is a popular open source project.
Yes, absolutely.
So that's kind of how we are going to solve it. So what we need to implement is, first we need to install it. Okay, that's not a big deal. Luckily, they even have an Amazon Linux 2 optimized like package for Fluentd to install. So that's really going to work very, very nicely on Amazon Linux 2. It also works for lots of other distributions. So it's very likely that you will find a good package here. Then we need some IAM policies. So because we want to upload to an S3 bucket, we have to allow Fluentd to upload to the bucket. And what I found is that when I was writing this policy, I actually had the need to figure out what API calls Fluentd makes, because at the beginning I only allowed put object, which kind of makes sense, but it was not working. And the error message was not very helpful. It just said access denied, not what operation was executed. And it turns out that Fluentd makes, or the plugin for uploading to S3 or Fluentd makes a get object request before they upload data. For some reasons, they make a head object call, which requires the get object permission. So I figured that out by looking at the UDP stream with using the TCP dump command. So that was very handy. I kind of used the same approach to actually set up this thing because it was already a problem. And then I also added the list bucket permission. And so this is not visible in the API calls, but there's this problem, or I don't know, it's a kind of a pitfall in S3. So if you make a get object call and the file does not exist, you get back a forbidden 403, I think. Mm-hmm. And if you allow the S3 list bucket operation, you get back a 404. So Fluentd expects to get back 404, so that's why I have to allow this bucket as well. But that's kind of that's a tricky one, but if you use S3, then you know that. And I think, yeah, lots of people run into this it's a pitfall there. So last but not least, we have to configure Fluentd. So in a nutshell, what we do is we listen on port 31,000, we parse the input as JSON, and then I do a transformation, and what I add is the host name. And I know this is a little bit, this could be improved. The host name is not, it contains all kinds of information, but not in a really nicely formatted way. It would be nice to get the instance ID, to get maybe the private IP and things like this, so all the metadata of the instance. And the good news is there is a plugin for that, a Fluentd plugin for that. So if you want to have all the metadata from the metadata service, you could inject that here as well. But I want to keep the example simple. That's why I go with without the native way of doing it, without installing an additional plugin. So I use the host name. So I enrich each entry with the host name. So this helps me later to differentiate calls coming from different machines. And after this enrichment, I upload the data to S3. And Fluentd does some smart things. It buffers the data, so it does not send every API call to S3. It waits for, in the way I configured it, for 10 minutes or for 256 megabytes. And if this chunk is collected, then it will send it up and it will also cheese a bit, and then it uploads it to S3. And then it's available for us for for analysis. So that's the next step that we have to take. And here it is really important that you wait a couple of days, because we need some data. If you immediately start with the next step, it will not going to work.
Mm. So probably depends a little bit on how the application is used, whether it's under high load, and also if you are going through all the different scenarios that are in the application. So maybe you have, I don't know, it could be you have something running at the end of the month or something that is, I don't know, uploading some data to S3 only at the end of the month. So it could be that you're then missing that. So yeah, the time spent that you're recording is definitely important here. Yeah.
Yeah, so that's a really good point, Andreas, because in one of the projects I was working on, we figured out that during deployments, lots of API calls are made, for example, that are not made if there are no deployments running. And during the time frame where I captured the data first, there was for some reason no one working on the application, so there was no deployment. So when I was looking through all the data, I was wondering, okay, why is this policy in the policy, but we never called this API? And then with some care, I figured out, okay, that looks really much like something that happens during a deployment, because it was involved with code deploy and things like this. So I just triggered a manual deployment and run the pipeline manually. And then, all of a sudden, I saw lots of different API calls that was never recorded before. So that's a very good point. You really have to make sure to invoke everything that runs on this machine, all the code paths, because we only record what we can observe. So we don't look into the source code. We only observe the application. And if it does not make the API calls, we don't know that the API calls are actually possible. So, okay, Andreas. So we now have the data in S3.
Michael, I have one question. So does it record only successful API calls or also the failed ones?
That's also a good point. It records both.
Okay, that's
cool. So you can also use this for debugging. And this is also, I used it for that as well. And it's a different use case that we have now with making IAM policies secure. But you can also use it for this scenario. It also reports latencies and all kinds of interesting data.
Okay, so in theory, I use it to record everything. I then modify my IAM policy, remove some statements and actions and so on. But then I can use the same thing to basically monitor if that is really working or if something breaks in production or something. Okay, that's cool.
Yeah, that's exactly the case. And you can, you probably don't want to use the S3 approach in this case because you have the 10-minute delay here. Mm. If that's fine for you, that's okay. But what I did in another project where we had exactly this use case is instead of connecting it to an S3 bucket, I connected it to CloudWatch Logs. And we had a very low latency between API call was made and we saw it in CloudWatch Logs. Then I had a CloudWatch Logs filter on top of it, and we basically did exactly what you said. So we alerted on access denies. So that's a very good way. And it's much faster than what you can achieve with CloudTrail, which has this 50-minute latency. And it's kind of...
Yeah, it's clumsy.
Yeah.
Actually, it's relatively useless. So at least for
that. I mean, if you really look at something and you want to figure out what's wrong, then if you always have to wait 50 minutes to see the result in CloudTrail, it's slowing you down. So that's definitely much faster here using client-side monitoring. So the feedback cycle is immediate, basically.
Yeah. So what is the good thing about CloudTrail compared to what we're talking here is that CloudTrail is really an audit log that no one can modify. So in that case, if I have access to the machine, I could, for example, filter out some of the requests I'm doing. So I cannot really use it as an audit log. I can use it for the scenarios that you have described. I think the use cases are a little bit different. The intent of CloudTrail is really to have an uncompromisable audit log of most things, I would say. Yeah, okay.
Yeah, so I'm not saying that CloudTrail is not useful here at all. That's not what I'm going to say. The only thing that I'm going to say is that if you want to optimize an IAM policy of an EC2 instance, then client-side monitoring is the better tool. And CloudTrail captures lots of interesting things, and as you said, you cannot turn it off, so that's the good thing. I mean, client-side monitoring, you have to turn it on, and you can turn it off, and so that's the big problem here. But and CloudTrail captures, all the administrative activity is captured in CloudTrail. Like if you start a machine, if you change the network, so that's all captured in CloudTrail. But the thing that I'm looking at here is things like getting messages from SQS, putting something in DynamoDB, like the calls that a machine actually makes, the application makes, and they are usually not visible in CloudTrail, and that's why things are so hard. Okay, so Andreas, we now have the data in S3. So what do you think how we are going to analyze it?
So it's JSON, so I think we could use Athena here.
Yeah, and I think that's one of your favorite services, right?
Absolutely.
So the way it works is... before we can use Athena, we have to create the schema. And when I was first looking into this service, it's called AWS Glue. It was not working that well, but this time I was surprised because it was just out of the box doing exactly what I wanted. So what we do first is we create a so-called Glue crawler, and we point the Glue crawler to the S3 bucket where the data is in. And then the Glue crawler just magically discovers the schema. And this works out of the box without any problems. So what we get out of that, as soon as the crawler is done with its job, it creates the table, and it also creates all the partitions in Athena. So this is a really efficient way then later for making queries where you only want to look at specific time or date ranges, basically. And that's all done by the Glue crawler. So it creates the necessary schema for Athena. And then once we have the schema, we can run queries on our data. And I have a couple of examples in the blog post. But basically, what you will end up doing is a call that groups by the service and by the API call, and then you just count how many API calls were made by which API call. And that's kind of the result that we can then use to optimize the policies. Now it gets interesting. I compared exactly the same time or date range with what I see in CloudTrail. So in CloudTrail, you could use different ways again of analyzing the data. And to make things a little bit more interesting, I go with a different route. You could use Athena as well and look at the data in S3, but I was looking into my CloudWatch log stream. So I use CloudWatch Insights and I run more or less the same query. So I group by the service and the API call that was made, and I count them, and then I sort them and in descending order. And it turns out that actually CloudTrail misses, in quantitative terms, it misses over 99% of the API calls in the example that I used. So things like CloudWatch logs put log events, not visible in CloudTrail, visible in client-side monitoring. SQS receive messages, not visible in CloudTrail at all. CloudWatch put metric data, not visible in CloudTrail at all. So there were at least 10 or 20 API calls that I saw in client-side monitoring that were not at all present in CloudTrail. And this is where things get very handy. If you now use the two data sources and combine them, you get a better understanding what actually goes on. If you see something in CloudTrail that you don't see in client-side monitoring, then you have forgot to turn CSM on for one of your processes. So you have to ensure that you go back and make sure that you really capture all the data. So I use it to kind of make sure that my data makes sense. So the numbers have to match, and I will be likely see more in client-side monitoring than I see in CloudTrail.
Very cool stuff, Michael. So that's really impressive. And I think especially for the data events, I think that those are in many applications that are running on EC2 or somewhere, those are the interesting API calls, because that's what usually an application is using. Very cool stuff.
Okay, so now we talked about the cool stuff, so let's talk about the stuff that's not so cool. So the method that I described is super handy to make sure that only actions, for like to make sure that the actions actually match with what you have in the policy. But the problem is the resource level constraints. Because in client-side monitoring, you don't get any information about the body of the request. So that's not visible. So you cannot tighten or optimize the resource level constraints. That is possible with CloudTrail. So in CloudTrail, you see the request body, but only for the requests that are captured by CloudTrail. So that's why I usually use this data that I have then, and then a conversation has to begin with either the developers of this software and the vendor of the software, or if they all not exist, we could agree on resource as a star, like no resource level constraints at all if you don't know, or we have to really figure it out by trial and error. But this is then going to be very, very hard. And I would like to see client-side monitoring an option to, I mean, I'm not sure why they don't publish it by default. Maybe, I think UDP has some like body length constraints, like the data, like the package cannot get like increasingly big. I'm not sure if that's the reason or if it's like of privacy or security reasons. But if you could turn this on additionally, I definitely think it could help. I mean, even better if the SDKs would just publish the YARN on which they work on, but I'm not think that this is going to happen soon. But yeah, that's the big problem of this approach. It only works for the actions. It's not going to work for resource level constraints. But still, this is the best thing that we have so far. So I have not seen any other method that goes like at this level of detail and captures so much data that we can use. Another thing to say here is that you can turn on some data events in CloudTrail. So for example, I think it's available for DynamoDB, and it's also available for S3. So that's an option as well, but you have to pay for that. It's not cheap. So if you really have high volume, then it might not be a good idea to turn it on. But that's also something to keep in mind. So I think that's it, Andreas. I really like the approach. I used it now over 3 times in projects, and I was really happy with it.
Cool, Michael. Yeah, thank you very much. So once again, I want to mention that there's a blog post going over that as well. So if you want to check the details, you will find the link for that in the show notes. So then, yeah, thanks for listening. We will talk to each other in 2 weeks again. And yeah, to all the listeners, thanks for listening. Feel free to send us your feedback. You will find links to Twitter, LinkedIn, email in the show notes. And please also recommend the podcast to a friend.
Yeah, Andreas, one thing to mention before we end here. So this is actually a shout out to Scott from Summit Route. So he wrote a blog post in May and kind of introduced client-side monitoring to me. And so that was really like eye-opening, and I didn't know about the feature. So it's kind of a hidden feature, I would say, of the SDKs. So that was really nice, a nice way to discover this feature. And then from there, I started working it basically. And with Fluentd and different options, tried it out. And it's really nice and a good way of optimizing policies, yeah. So thank you very much, Andreas, and see you in 2 weeks.
Perfect.
Bye.
Yeah, bye.